Hare he In his introduction, Abai reflected on the time when, as a young schoolboy, he had attended a lecture, Vidya Ratna, the jewel of education. The theme of the lecture had been that God does not exist and could not exist. If there were God, he would have certainly appeared on earth to put an end to all religious rivalry. But since God had not obliged man in this way, we should banish all thought of his existence from our minds. The audience, Abai explained, consisting only of so many young boys, did not delve deeply into the subject matter of the lecture. Yet the majority, impressed by the arguments, carried away lofty ideas of godlessness and thus became agnostics at home. Abai had not been satisfied with the agnostic conclusion, quote, because I had been trained by my father to be engaged in the worship of Sri Sri Radha Govinda. But as a result of the Vidyaratna lecture, I was experiencing some mental conflict between agnosticism and the existence of Godhead. Later, having heard from the spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, Abai understood that the personality of Godhead exists in every sphere of activity. Quote, but we do not have the eyes to see him, end quote. Abai wrote, quote, even if the Lord personally manifests himself on earth, the quarreling mundaners will not stop their fighting and look upon Godhead or his representative due to ignorance. This is the birthright of the individual soul by the grace of Godhead. In other words, we can say that, you know, why God doesn't come and correct everything here. But then the point is we're taking it that all these events are happening independent of us. You know what I'm saying? The point is that the living entity, the results of what's going on here is happening because of the activities of the living entity. Does that make any sense? What do you think? Yes? Okay? So that means all the trouble you get into, who creates that trouble? You. Very smart boy. Okay. Now, when you're doing something and making trouble, do you like it when the teachers come along and tell you don't do it, or you would rather make the trouble and have some fun?
I won't like it.
You wouldn't like it if the teachers came. So, in the same way, if people are sitting here playing around the material world doing all their nonsense, then they wouldn't actually appreciate it if God came and straightened everything out and made everything work nice. You understand? So, therefore, he doesn't come. He comes at his scheduled times, but he doesn't come just because, you know, this person started a war or that country or this or that or all these different things, right? Because people don't actually want. So that's Prabhupada's point, is even if he did come, everyone would be fighting so much they wouldn't even notice. Right? Srila Prabhupada came, how many people noticed? Because they're so busy with their mundane affairs. So this whole idea of, well, God should step in, this, that, that's our point of view. We're saying that. But we're making the trouble and saying God has to straighten out all the mess. You know what I'm saying? So that's the problem. Right? So this whole idea is just because he doesn't show up on that doesn't mean that doesn't prove he's not there. Otherwise we say, you know, well, if the prime minister of the country doesn't come here now and straighten this out, then he doesn't exist. You know what I'm saying? But it doesn't work like that. You know, they are overseeing the whole thing. And if we make a mess out of it, then we need to work it out. Because God gives us the direction in Shastra how to live properly so we don't make trouble. And even if there is trouble, how to straighten it out. But our idea is that why we should do it, someone else should do it. Right? Like God should work out all the mess. But I'll make endeavor to enjoy. Why shouldn't I make endeavor to work out the problem? No? You understand? So like that, then they come up with these foolish ideas that God doesn't exist because he doesn't do what we want. But that does not exactly. Just because the parents don't do what the small child wants doesn't mean they suddenly stop to exist. Right? Does that make sense? Right? So the parents should provide the kid with all kinds of snacks and ice cream and everything like that. And, you know, all the mess he makes in his room and in the backyard and everything, they should clean that up, right? And if they don't do that, then they don't exist. Right? Would that work? No. So that's the whole point. So why would it be any different with God? Yeah? Yes? No? What do you think? Yeah? Do you think? Very good, very good, very good. Does he think? He thinks. Does he think? He said he thinks. Does he think? Yes, okay. You guys got something going here. Yes. No. Why no? You don't agree. So what? If you don't agree, then what is your presentation? You agree. Okay, so it's a yes, not a no. Okay. Okay. Bhagavad Gita is the true, quote, jewel of education, right? Because Vidyaratna means the jewel of education. And in that, and in the Gita, Lord Krishna declares, to the fighting people on earth, here I am, do not quarrel. The agnostic who had spoken of the jewel of education had been blinded by the jewel and therefore could not see and appreciate the personality of Godhead. Thus he had gone on to convince others to become so-called jewels also. Right? In other words, they have this jewel and then they become bewildered by it because it's so bright. Right? And so this brightness, you know, of the qualities in that, they're seeing all these qualities, but they don't attribute it to the person. Does that make sense? Right? The light is very bright, you don't attribute it to the light bulb, you just see the light and appreciate it. You like the light and doing everything with the light, but you won't necessarily recognize the light bulb. Does that make sense? Yeah? Following his spiritual master, Abhay displayed an aggressive spirit for confronting all opponents of pure theism. In responding to his spiritual master's order to develop into an English preacher, Abhay was not simply making neutral scholarly presentations. He was willingly and ready to fight, whether against modern agnostics or Vaishnavism's old traditional enemy, Mayavad impersonalism. Right? In other words, this idea, it's not that we just sit here and be so, yes, it's nice, and yes, you can do whatever, and this. No, it's a matter of there are standards, and so we're willing to stand up and, you know, how you say, fight over these points, right? So that's the preaching in our line. It's very, very strong and all that. Because otherwise, if you're on the fence like that, you present very nicely, it sounds good, but still nobody will be convinced and nobody will practice. Right? Because to practice God consciousness means you have to be convinced. And you, despite everybody else not being engaged, you have to be willing to engage. So that takes conviction. Right? So that means unless you preach with conviction, how anyone is going to take that and apply it in their life with conviction? Does that make sense? What happens if you put yogurt into milk? What happens?
It makes yogurt.
Okay. So that would mean if you put in conviction, then that is what people will take on. They will be convinced. Right? And if you just do some nice neutral scholarly presentations, then, you know, it's intellectually very interesting, but it stops there. It doesn't actually convince the living entity. Does that make sense? Right? So that's the thing, is that these persons, they're making these very, from their own point of view, they're convinced, and they're going around and trying to make people into that they don't believe in God. So they're very aggressive about it. So then, why we wouldn't be just as aggressive in trying to establish that there's God? Why should we be all pleasant and nice? They're not being pleasant and nice. Yes? No? Maybe? Yes. Okay. What do you think? Yes. And you? Yes. Yes what? You'll take a little bit more moody or a bit more mystery in the milk or that also? Okay. Although few scholars taught the way of surrender to Lord Krishna as espoused in Bhagavad Gita. What is espoused? Espoused means this as spoken or given, as what someone is presenting something. So that's they're espousing. Yeah. Just like I say, one of the boys, gives his espousement on, what he feels is the proper way to, the appropriate way to play marbles, something like that. He will espouse so much philosophy that you like this or that, or the hole in the ground should be this big or this far apart, or so many things like that. Does that make sense? Okay. Almost all respected Bhagavad Gita as presenting the essence of all knowledge. The Gita, therefore, was the perfect vehicle for confronting those who misrepresented God and religion. The Gita was, quote, a challenge to the agnostics, apotheists, and anthropomorphists, impersonalists, henotheists, pantheists, and absolute monists. Okay. Although they were already more than 600 commentaries on Bhagavad Gita, they had been written by persons with, quote, an inner hatred for the personality of Godhead, and therefore were imperfect. Quote, such envious persons, Abai wrote, have no entrance into the real meaning of Bhagavad Gita. Inasmuch as a fly cannot enter into the covered jar of honey. Abai described Indian culture as an almost impassable ocean due to its depth of thought and apparent mixtures of conclusion. Quote, but in his book, Abai declared, I will establish that Krishna is the absolute personality of Godhead by referring to the available records of scriptures, which are the recorded history of Indian culture and thought. The sannyasis at 7 Banerjee Lane were impressed by the scope of Abai's thoughts and intentions. As it was customary to award a title to an especially worthy Vaishnava according to his qualities, Bhakti Sharanga Goswami wanted to confer upon Abai the title Bhakti Siddhanta. Sridhar Maharaj, however, thought it inappropriate to give Abai the same title as the spiritual master. And he asked that Abai's title be changed to Bhaktivedanta. Bhakti meaning devotion, and Vedanta meaning the end of knowledge. Abhay was grateful. The title combined the devotion of religion with the scholarship of the most rigorous philosophy, as passed down by the scholarly followers of Lord Chaitanya. He appreciated the sincere gesture of his godbrothers and accepted the title as a further commitment to his spiritual path of preaching Krishna's consciousness. Because Bhakti Siddhanta, Siddhanta means conclusion, and Vedanta also means conclusion, so it's considered the same. So he felt that it would be the same title, but you'd use different words, so it wouldn't sound like Bhaktisiddhanta. We see Srila Prabhupada also maintaining that the highest course after Bhaktivedanta was Bhaktisarvabhauma instead of Bhaktisiddhanta. Right? So he maintained that same culture. Abhay continued regularly associating with Sridhar Maharaj and discussing with him Srimad Bhagavatam. Abhay encouraged him to preach widely, although Sridhar Maharaj was admittedly more the scholar and rather shy about going out and preaching. On several occasions, Abhay tried to convince Sridhar Maharaj to go with him and charge Gandhi and Nehru as to why they weren't following the principles of Bhagavad Gita. Another fruit of the spiritual association at 7 Banerjee Lane was a book called Prapanna Jivanamritam, compiled by Sridhar Maharaj, a collection of verses from various Vaishnava scriptures, including excerpts from the works of Rupa Goswami. It was divided into 6 chapters, according to the 6 divisions of surrender. Abhay, along with his sannyasis of the Devananda Saraswati Math, financed the publication. Thus it was published as a joint effort by friends. Yes? Finance, or means here that they financed the publication. Finance means that they gave the money for it, right? So finance means it means the dealing with money, like that. So if you financed it, then it means you gave money for that particular project. So here it was publishing a book, so they financed the publication, right? When you make a book, then you publish it. So they financed the publication. Yeah? Yes? No? September 3rd, 1939. Lord Linlithgow, Viceroy of India, announced that India was at war with Germany. Thus, England swept India into the war without consulting any Indians. Although independence-minded India certainly resented such a show of foreign control, there were mixed feelings about the war. India wanted independence, yet she sympathized with the Allied cause against fascism in the West and feared an invasion by Imperial Japan in the East. Quote, "Since you dislike the British so violently," one author asked a typical New Delhi student of the day, "would you want Japan to invade and conquer India?" Student, "No, but we Indians pray that God may give the British enough strength to stand up under the blows they deserve." Okay. Although at the outbreak of the war, India had only 175,000 men in her armed forces, the British managed to increase the number of Indian soldiers to 2 million. Wow. There was no draft, but the British sent recruiting agents all over India, especially in the Punjab, where military service seemed an attractive offer to the local poor. The Punjabis proved good fighters, whereas Bengalis enlisted as officers, doctors, contractors, and clerks. Yes. Indian soldiers were dispatched to battlefields in Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Persia, Malaya, Burma, and Assam. That's amazing. They were fighting in Iraq. While the British were attempting to mobilize Indians for the war, the Indian nationalist movement, which had continued off and on for more than 20 years, became very active. Members of the Congress Party refused to cooperate with the war effort and demanded guaranteed independence for India. Some thought that since England had her hands full with Germany, the time was ripe to revolt and gain independence by force. Gandhi's position had been one of unconditional pacifism, and he had opposed the idea of Indians taking up arms, even to defend India. But by 1942, he had become more inimical and reduced his policy towards the British to a simple, unequivocal, quit India. Thousands of Indians responded by chanting slogans in the street and even by tearing up the railway lines. Abai's militant former schoolmate, Subhas Chandra Bose, fought against the British in his own way. He had approached Hitler in Germany and gotten him to agree that when the Germans captured Indian soldiers, Germany would return them to Bose, who had maintained them in his nationalist army. With his army, Bose planned to return to India and drive the British from Indian soil. But dissatisfied with his progress in Germany, Bose made a similar agreement with Tojo in Japan, and soon thousands of Gurkhas and Sikhs, the best fighters in the Indian army, had defected from the British army to join Bose's freedom fighters in Singapore. Bose began to prepare his army to invade India from the north. Then in 1943, the British found that the Japanese, who had already taken Burma, were at the doors of India, approaching Bengal, by their tactic known as the denial policy, right? Denial policy means you go ahead and do all aggressive things, and then when you're asked about it, you say, no, we're not doing that, right? They're going in and taking country by country. And then, no, we're not. We're just out on a, we're out on a walk, you know, fresh air and everything. You know, Japan's very small, not enough space to walk. So we're out just touring around like that. The British sank many Indian boats carrying food and destroyed large rice crops, fearing that they would fall into the hands of the enemy. This left local Indians starving and without the boats they needed for trade. Right? Instead of just putting armies there, then they harass the people that they're supposed to protect. Right? The famine had ensued was the worst that had hit Bengal in 150 years. The government removed all control of food costs, and those who could not afford to buy at the skyrocketing prices died in the streets of Calcutta. Right? And then the British would wonder why the people wouldn't want independence, right? So they're worried the Japanese are going to come and take all these things, but then just as they raised 2 million members of an army to fight in Europe, so why couldn't they also raise people to fight on the borders of India to keep the Japanese out? You understand? So in other words, that wasn't the priority. If the people starved in India, this, that, it didn't matter because the resources are the same. Right? Whether there's more people or less people, the resources they want to exploit are the same. So they're not actually worried about the people. So this is would be, you can see, the basis of why these empires lost everything, right? Because the British took over so much, the Dutch, the Spanish, the French, you know, who else? Italians did a little bit. You know, different these European countries, they went out and conquered, you know, basically the whole world. And were controlling all these areas. But they were only controlling them so that they could get the wealth from the countries. They weren't actually doing it to protect the people. And so because the people aren't protected, then they revolt and then they kick them out. You understand? So in administration, the most important thing is protection. Right? You have to take care of those who are under you. You take care, then everything works nice. You don't take care, it doesn't work nice. Something up, Mr. Thomas? No? Okay. I mean, I'm assuming his name is Thomas because he showed up on the first day with a t-shirt that said Thomas. So I thought he must be Thomas. Srila Prabhupada, I have got experience. The government created artificial famine. The war was going on. So Mr. Churchill's policy was to keep the people in scarcity so they will volunteer to become soldiers. So this policy was executed. Big men, they collected the rice. Rice was selling at 6 rupees per mon. All of a sudden, it came to 50 rupees per mon. It was in the grocer's shop. I was in the grocer's shop purchasing. And all of a sudden, the grocer said, "No, no, I'm not going to sell anymore." At that moment, the price was 6 rupees per mon. So suddenly, he was not going to sell. A few hours later, I went back to purchase, and the rice had gone up to 50 rupees per mon. So, yeah. And so this was Mr. Churchill's policy, right? So, like this. So then, you know, so many people then starved to death because of this. And then he's considered, and they consider that they're doing some good. You know what I'm saying? So with people like that, that's not the you go and inspire people to join the army. You don't starve them to death, and then, you know, what few are left, maybe they'll join. The government appointed agents began to purchase the rice and other commodities which are daily necessities. They can offer any price because the currency is in their hands. They can print so-called papers, $100, and pay. A man becomes satisfied thinking, "Oh, I have $100, but this is a piece of paper." That was the policy. You have no money, no rice, so another avenue is open. Yes, you become a soldier, you get so much money. People out of poverty would go there. I have seen it. No rice was available in the market, and people were hungry. They were dying. Abai managed to purchase just enough for his own family to survive. But he saw the beggar population increase by the hundreds. Month after month, he saw the footpaths and open spaces congested with beggars, cooking their food on improvised stoves and sleeping in the open or beneath the trees. He saw starving children rummaging in the dustbins for a morsel of food. From there, it was but a step to fighting with the dogs for a share of the garbage. And this also became a familiar sight in the Calcutta streets. The British had little time to spare from their war efforts, and they worked only to save those lives essential for their fight. For the common people, the empire's prescription was uniform and simple. Was uniform and simple starvation. Srila Prabhupada. One American gentleman was present at that time. He remarked, "People are starving in this way. In our country, there would have been revolution." Yes, but the people of India are so trained that in spite of artificial famine, they do not commit theft, stealing others' property. People were dying. Still they thought, "All right, God has given." That was the basic principle of Vedic civilization. Yeah, it was said that the shops that were selling food, people wouldn't steal like that. So they would starve to death, but they wouldn't steal. So that at that time, there was nothing. I think it only started after the stealing started after the Bangladesh war, when some influx, huge influx of persons came in and all that. But somehow or another, the culture had gone down, that then so much thievery and everything started, and then that became a standard kind of activity. But before that, people wouldn't steal.
Abai knew that under the laws of nature, there was no scarcity. By God's arrangement, the earth could produce enough food. The trouble was man's greed. Quote, "There is no scarcity in the world," Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had said. "The only scarcity is of Krishna consciousness." And this was how Abai saw the 1943 famine. Now more than ever, the spiritual vision was relevant. Krishna consciousness was the prime necessity. How else could man be checked from his evil propensities to become greedy, hoard, make war, and thus create misery for millions? He had seen the heinous activities of the British in India. The cutting off the thumbs of the weavers so that the Indian-made cotton goods could not compete with the foreign-made cloth. The shooting down of unarmed innocent citizens. The creating artificial famine. The propagating the myth that Indian civilization was primitive. Still, he did not believe that an independent Indian government would necessarily be an improvement. Unless the leadership was Krishna conscious, and neither Gandhi or Subhas Chandra Bose was, then the government was. Okay. Then the government would be able to provide no real solutions, only stopgap measures. So unless the government was God consciousness, when he saw that Subhas Chandra Bose and Gandhi, even though they themselves were, you know, devotees, and this, they weren't making the movement based on God consciousness, right? They weren't pushing this forward. So basically, they were only functioning in the political field. So even though he saw that the British were doing so much nonsense, and none of it was correct and all that, but by changing the government, you didn't actually necessarily improve the situation of the individuals that are there. You know what I'm saying? Because unless you become God conscious, then there won't be any real lasting benefit. So you could see, we can see now the change from before. He thought, no, you have to be independent first, then you can establish the culture. But Bhaktisiddhanta says, Sadhu Thakur was saying, you know, whether independence is there or not, Krishna consciousness is so important, it has to be established now, no matter what the political situation is. Yeah? Without obedience to the laws of God, as expressed by the scriptures and sages, governments would only increase human suffering, right? Because they're just engaged in politics. When Calcutta was bombed day after day, the bombing was concentrated in specific areas, right here. They're starving the people, doing all this, making all these arrangements, but they're not working in any way to protect India from all that. The bombing was concentrated in specific areas, such as Kidderpur Port Facility and Shambazar in North Calcutta, very near Abai's home at Sitakanta Banerjee Lane. American planes had been leaving from airfields near Calcutta for targets in China and Japan. So the air raids on Calcutta seemed an inevitable retaliation. It was the Japanese striking back. Right, Kidderpur is right on the Ganga, that's where all the big ships in the ports are. And then the Shambazar, that was the main bazaar up in North Calcutta. That's where all the people were staying. Or was it the Japanese striking back? Or was it? Some said it was the forces of Subhas Chandra Bose, since the bombs fell mostly in the European quarter. But for the people of Calcutta, it made little difference who was attacking. After the first bombing, people evacuated the city. Blackouts were imposed. And at night, the entire city was dark. Srila Prabhupada, the whole Calcutta became vacant. Perhaps only myself and a few others remained. I sent my sons to Navadvip. Of course, my daughter was married. My wife refused to go out of Calcutta. She said, I'll be bombed, but I will not go. So I had to remain in Calcutta. I have seen bombing in Calcutta all night. I was just eating when there was the siren. So the arrangement was that in your house would be the shelter room. I was hungry, so I first finished eating. Then I went to the room, and the bombing began. Chi Kyam. I was thinking that this was also Krishna in another form, but that form was not very lovable. Yeah, so Prabhupada is able to see Krishna in everything. But the point is Krishna in everything, that's true, but there are then the more lovable forms of Krishna. So therefore Krishna in Vrindavan, that's lovable. Krishna's form is the deity of the holy name. But Krishna as the power of the explosion and all that, of the bomb, then that's not exactly what you'd call lovable. Yes? In the midst of these calamities, Abai felt more than ever the need to propagate Krishna consciousness. He had something to say to the war-weary citizens of the world, and he longed for a more effective forum, a publication of some kind, a way to present the world's crisis through the eyes of Scripture in the same bold style as had his spiritual master. There was no shortage of ideas, and he had been saving money from his business for this very purpose. Yet, how could he dare produce such a journal when even learned sannyasi senior disciples of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta were not? He never considered himself a great scholar among his godbrothers, although they called him Kavi, and now Bhaktivedanta, As a grihasta, he wasn't expected to take the lead or publish his own journal. But times had changed. The English journal, The Harmonist, had not been published since before Bhaktisiddhanta's passing away. Now, almost a decade had passed, and the Gaudiya Mutt had been too busy fighting in court to consider preaching. Long gone was the tireless spirit that for 10 consecutive years had produced the daily Nadiya Prakash. No longer were four separately located printing presses pumping out transcendental literature under the direction of Bhakti Vinod Thakur's empowered son. The presses had been sold by Kunja Bihari. Times had changed. The Gaudiya Mutt was only fighting, while the non-devotees were killing each other in a world war. Right, so you can see it's when the Mutt is fighting, then all these things are coming up. From his front room at 6 Sita Kanta Banerjee, oh, I guess the Gaudiya Mutt was 7 Sita Kanta Banerjee, right? They were upstairs. Abai conceived, wrote, edited, and typed the manuscript for a magazine. He designed a logo, a long rectagonal, across the top of the page. In the upper left corner was a figure of Lord Chaitanya, effulgent with rays of light like rays from the sun. In the lower right were silhouettes of a crowd of people in darkness, but groping to receive light from Lord Chaitanya. And between Lord Chaitanya and the people, the title unfurled like a banner, back to Godhead. In the lower right corner was a picture of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, seated at his writing, looking up thoughtfully as he composed. Above the logo ran the motto, Godhead is light, nescience is darkness. Where there is Godhead, there is no nescience. Below the logo were the following lines, edited and founded under the direct order of His Divine Grace, Sri Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada by Mr. Abhay Charan Day. Abhay had already gained some printing experience in connection with his business, and after completing the manuscript, he brought it to Saraswati Press, the best printers in Bengal. He also hired an agent, Calcutta's prestigious booksellers, Thacker, Spink and Company, who would take responsibility for distributing the journal to bookstores and libraries, including outlets in several foreign countries. But when he went to buy paper, he met with government restrictions. Because of the war and the subsequent paper shortage, they wanted to assay what he had written in terms of the national needs. During this time of world crisis, an ordinary citizen's religious newspaper was hardly top priority. Abhay's request for paper was perfunctorily denied, but he persisted. He appealed that using paper to print the teachings of the personality of Godhead was not a waste and not untimely in the present troubled atmosphere. Finally, he obtained permission to print his first edition of Back to Godhead, a 44-page publication. Abhay Charan greeted his readers by defining his motto, Godhead is light, nescience is darkness. When man forgets that he is the son of Godhead and identifies himself with a body, then he's in ignorance. He's like a man who's very concerned with the automobile's mechanism, yet with no knowledge of the driver. In other words, you have a car and it's not moving, so you're dealing with the mechanism of the car, but not paying attention that you need a driver in the car to make the car work. Right? Yes. Well, so if you want the car to go where you want, then you adjust the carburetor or the distributor or put some oil in it, or right? That's what makes it go move around. No, what makes it move around?
The driver.
The driver. Okay. So that's the problem, is they're paying attention to the machine but not to the driver of the machine. Yes? What do you think? Yes? Okay. So are you paying attention to the driver of the machine? Not sure. Okay. Okay, so quoting from the book. The defect of the present-day civilization is just like that. This is actually the civilization of nescience or illusion, and therefore civilization has been turned into militarization. Everyone is fully concerned with the comforts of the body and everything related with the body, and no one is concerned with the spirit that moves the body, although even a boy can realize that the motor car mechanism has little value if there's no driver of the car. This dangerous ignorance of humanity is a gross nescience and has created a dangerous civilization in the form of militarization. This militarization, which, in softer language, is nationalization, is an external barrier to understanding human relations. There is no meaning in a fight where the parties do fight only for the matter of different colored dresses. There must be, therefore, an understanding of human relations without any consideration of the bodily designation or colored dresses. Back to Godhead is a feeble attempt by the undersigned, under the direction of His Divine Grace Sri Srimad Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada, the celebrated founder and organizer of the Gaudiya Math activities, just to bring up a real relation of humanity with central relation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That there is a great and urgent need of a literature like this is keenly felt by the leaders of all countries, and the following statements will help much in the procedure. Right. So he's saying is that you can go on with all these different things, but the problem is what's happened is this civilization, all it is just fighting over their borders and who does what do you wear, what flag you're flying, all these different things. But the actual purpose of human life to become God conscious, that they're missing the point. So they're fighting over these things, but still nobody becomes God conscious. They're administering, nobody becomes God conscious, right? They're generating so much wealth, still nobody becomes God conscious. In other words, it just becomes a waste of time. Yes? What do you think? And what about this waste of time? So you were pointing at your watch to prove how much time was wasted, or you were pointing out in just 7 minutes the class will be over and then you can get up and run around and yell and scream. No. Just checking. It was 1944 and Abai specifically addressed the crisis of world war. The world's political leaders were expressing their disgust at their people's suffering and scarcity. After 4 years of fighting, costing millions of human lives, the Second World War within 20 years was still scourging the earth. Although the end was in sight, leaders expressed not much happiness and hope as weariness and uncertainty. Even if this war ended, would there be yet another war? Had man not yet grasped the vital lesson of how to live in peace? Abai quoted the Archbishop of India, quote, "India, guided by God, can lead the world back to sanity," end quote. He quoted the President of the United States, quote, "A program, therefore, of moral rearmament for the world cannot fail to lessen the dangers of armed conflict. Such moral rearmament to be most highly effective must receive support on a worldwide basis." He mentioned former President Herbert Hoover. I think at that time it was Roosevelt, what he quoted. So he's quoted the Archbishop of India saying that India guided by God can lead the world to peace, right? Back to sanity, because India has all this knowledge and Shastra and everything like that. And then the President of the United States is saying rearmament means arm means you take up weaponry. So you arm yourself with actual, proper morality, proper behavior. With that, then there'll be, less fighting and all that. Otherwise, they're doing this fighting, but by this time, there are no real rules anymore to fighting, not much. Right? Previously, they would fight, out in the fields and that, but So up to World War I, it was like that. Well, World War II, the fighting was in the cities like that. There'd be things outside also, but the war would happen in the cities. Previously, they wouldn't fight in the cities. Right? So everything is just falling apart. He mentioned former President Herbert Hoover, who had affirmed that the world needs to return to moral and spiritual ideals. And he quoted a resolution by the British House of Commons, affirming that spiritual principles are the common heritage of all people, and that men and nations urgently need to acquire and need to acknowledge the sovereignty of God. He quoted Wendell Willkie, who after his return from Russia had reported millions of Russians killed, wounded, or missing in the war, and millions more suffering from a winter of terrible scarcity and subjugation. What is true for the Russian people, Abhay wrote, is also true for other people. And we Indians are feeling the same scarcity, the same want, and the same disgust. Quote. He quoted British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden, who had been filled with lamentation and indignation at the miseries of war. He quoted the Archbishop of Canterbury. Archbishop Canterbury is like the head bishop, or the head, you know, church of the Church of England, like that. So it seems to be the major. So the Archbishop of Canterbury is considered the kind of like the top of the pile, other than the king. Yes? What do you think? Okay. So what does it mean, an archbishop? He has to sit on top of an arch or something like that. Or he has to walk always bowed over like an arch. That's an arch? So you're saying the archbishop looks something like that? No? Okay. Somehow or another, that's how what they call them. Right? Exactly, I'm not sure. Okay, so quoting the archbishop, in every quarter of earth, men long to be delivered from the curse of war, and to find in a world which has regained its peace this respite from the harshness and bitterness of the world they have known till now. But so often they want the kingdom of heaven without its king, the kingdom of God without God, and they cannot have it. Our resolve must be back to God. We make plans for the future of peace amongst the nation and for civil security at home. That is quite right enough, and it would be wrong to neglect it. But all our plans will come to shipwreck on the rock of human selfishness unless we turn to God, back to God. That is the chief need of England and of every nation. Right? So he's saying is that unless people become God conscious, then they actually won't be able to experience peace. And you know, protecting their country and doing all those different things is necessary. You must do that, right? Rupa Goswami mentions you have to take care of ordinary dealings. But he's saying that unless you connect yourself back to God, then how are you going to get that peace? Because the peacefulness and everything means everything's working according to God's laws. And if you don't accept God, then how are you actually going to experience this peace? Yes? No? He also quoted Sir Francis Younghusband. I wonder if his father was, you know, Sir Francis Oldhusband. Younghusband. That's a pretty far out name. I've never heard that name before. You ever heard that name? Younghusband. Kind of young. Kind of young husband. Used to be young husband. Quote, now that religion is everywhere attacked brutally, we look to India, the very home of religion, for a sign. Yeah, so in other words, we can see is that when the times are very rough, then people tend to become God-conscious and all that. So that's why when devotees were so worried about war and what will happen, God-consciousness isn't the problem.
God consciousness people tend to be more worried because they're not in control, so they have to turn to a higher authority. So we see here is that everybody is making that point that God consciousness is what's important, and for that one can look to India. So even then they had more of an understanding, though they were more, how do you say, you know, the Indians were savages, but still they seemed to have some idea of religion. What is going on here?
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki.